Today's reading is a passage of American scripture. Henry David Thoreau was born in 1817 in Concord, Massachusetts, a six-hour walk from Boston, or an hour's drive if you're commuting in rush hour these days. When he was 28, he built a cabin in the woods near Walden Pond, 2 miles out of town. He started work in March, digging a cellar first, and he bought a shanty from an Irish immigrant family who was moving out of the area. Thoreau took it apart, board by board, nail by nail, and he hauled the materials to the pond and he built his place. He bought secondhand windows and bricks. He got a book from the library on masonry to learn how to build a chimney and fireplace. By July of 1845, it was ready. Thoreau lived in the cabin for 2 years. He treated his time there as an experiment in simplifying his life, as a private retreat and an opportunity for self-study. Later, he published the book, Walden. He says this, "I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life and see if I could not learn what it had to teach, and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived. I did not wish to live what was not life. Living is so dear. Nor did I wish to practice resignation unless it was quite necessary. I wanted to live deep and suck out all the marrow of life, to live so sturdily and Spartan-like as to put to rout all that was not life, to cut a broad swath and shave close, to drive life into a corner and reduce it to its lowest terms. And if it proves to be mean, then to get the whole and genuine meanness of it and publish its meanness to the world. Or if life is sublime, to know it by experience and to be able to give a true account of it." Here ends the reading.
Henry David Thoreau once said, "Many men go fishing all their lives without knowing that it is not fish they are after." I don't know when the trouble in my relationship began. Maybe it began before the relationship started. I've always had interesting timing that way. It took me a long time to see it. She would spend longer hours at work. I would not notice. I was living with a woman in Vermont, and the relationship was breaking up. I didn't know it, of course. I had some things working against me. I was not a great listener, and I was male. Male. A woman once told me that's really the same thing. But I beg to differ. Still, at the time, I didn't see it coming. I've tried to stick to things I know. What I knew is that I loved to go fishing. There are awe-inspiring streams in Vermont, and the landscape is beautiful every season of the year. You could spend hours there with time becoming just a lure you don't use anymore, down at the bottom of the tackle box. I'd begun stopping by a stream on my way home from work at the hospital in Burlington. I probably looked ridiculous with my sports coat and tie, out fishing in a stream, just off the road a half mile or so. But I wasn't particularly worried about what I looked like. I rarely caught anything. It didn't matter to me. Between you and me, it's hard to define what I was after. I'm sure it wasn't something at home or in my tackle box. It wasn't swimming in the stream either. But being there, I could hear the water and smell the leaves. I could taste the essence of sadness and love and pain and beauty and healing all on the side of a stream.
Thank you, Ross. Thank you, Larry. Live your life, not somebody else's. Your life is important, so make sure you are awake for it. No being is isolated, human or otherwise. Everyone is connected to every other life in this world, interconnected, mutually dependent, and morally responsible. This is the gospel of Henry David Thoreau to me. In honor of his 200th birthday this year, I want to remember the rich inheritance we have from this prophet of simplicity and morality. Born in 1817, Henry David Thoreau lived his life in Concord, Massachusetts. His father owned a pencil manufacturing company. He worked there for a time. Though eventually that firm did well, the family was not always well off. They could afford to put only one of their two sons through college, and this was Henry David. His mother and sisters were active in the feminist movement at the time, yet women could not attend Harvard College as he could. In fact, Radcliffe College for Women was not founded until 1879. So Henry David lived at Harvard College from age 16 to age 20. In addition to working for the family business, Thoreau was a teacher. Actually, he was often a failed teacher. He was fired or he quit teaching in a public school because it was expected that you would flog children every day with a cane, and he wouldn't. And then he and his brother took over a school, and that didn't last very long. For a time, he tutored the children of his mentor, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and he stayed in their house. When he built his cabin by the pond, it was on land owned by the Emerson family. He stayed there for 2 years and 2 months till Emerson asked him to move back and help with the children. Thoreau says, however, that his experiment in the woods had come to its natural conclusion, and that's why he left. While at the cabin, Henry David Thoreau wrote his book about a boating journey he had made to New Hampshire with his brother John in 1839. Its title is A Week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers. John died young of lockjaw, tetanus, 3 years after their trip, and that book was written in memory of him. Though Henry David was a nonconformist, he was not a hermit, not a recluse. Staying a half mile from the nearest neighbor gave him time alone for reading, walking, and writing, but it also gave him company when he wanted it. In his book, Walden, he says he likes talking with other people. He says he recruited some neighbors to help him frame his house, not that he couldn't frame it alone, but he asked them in order to promote neighborliness. I understand. When I can bring myself to ask others for help, I realize how much others enjoy being generous. It makes a connection. When you have a talent you can offer or some time available, doesn't it feel nice sometimes when somebody asks you for a hand and you can provide it? Reaching out to give help and receive it, this is the practice of interdependence. In the book, Thoreau tallies the cost of materials for the house, $28.12. Not counting his labor in digging the cellar or nailing the boards or hauling the lumber. He says he went into town for work as a tutor and to do odd jobs as a handy person. He shared his money with his family and made repairs at home. They did what little laundry he had and served him dinner occasionally. He went fishing a few times for food, and once he ate a woodchuck. Mostly, however, he stuck to a vegetarian diet. He would pick berries and chestnuts and work in his field of peas and beans. In fact, he says, the rows of his bean field would extend 7 miles if set end to end. He sounds to me like a modern zucchini gardener when he says, I came to love my rows, though so many more than I wanted. His labors were always in relationship. He says, my helpers are the dews and rains which water this dry soil, and what fertility is in the soil itself. My enemies are worms, cool days, and most of all, woodchucks. Woodchucks once ate a quarter of an acre of his beans. The spiritual highlights of his writing are intermingled with his close observation of nature. Once the pond had frozen over, he got down on the ice and looked. For 3 pages, he describes the air bubbles in the layers of ice, their varied shapes and sizes, and the squeaks and pops of the air in the ice. Later, on a warm, sunny morning, he sat in the doorway letting the birds fly in and observing a mosquito humming in the sunlight. His mystical moments are lovely throughout the book. Furthermore, in all of his writings, his close observations of nature and the weather have been useful to later scientists who have used his record of that local area to measure changes in climate patterns. Thoreau is a 19th century example of being spiritual but not religious. As a young man, Thoreau resigned from the first parish of Concord, the Unitarian Church, where he had been christened as a baby and brought up in a liberal Christian atmosphere. In the Boston culture of the 1830s, it was not fashionable to opt out of a church. In our time, however, it is not common to seek one out. Now it's countercultural to belong to a spiritual community. As a writer, Henry David was part of the Transcendentalist movement of New England in the 1830s and 40s. His close friends were Unitarians, including ministers and former ones like Ralph Waldo Emerson. The Transcendentalists challenged the Christian Unitarianism in which they had grown up. To them, it was cold, conventional, strict, and limiting spiritually. People like Henry David would fit in much better with today's Unitarian Universalist movement than in their old churches. For example, he studied various religions which most Americans had never heard of. He embraced the scriptures of Hinduism and quoted from them. He compared the Buddhist teachings to the ministry of Jesus Christ. He called on the gods and goddesses of ancient Greece and Rome. And of course, he studied the divine by noticing the natural world. Living as much as he could outside, observing nature and loving it. His writing does not condemn religious inspiration, only the religious conformity which inhibits our spiritual growth. Furthermore, Thoreau's words condemn all forms of conformity, including the change of tastes and fashions in society. Every generation laughs at the old fashions, but follows religiously the new fashions, he says. The 20th century writer Kurt Vonnegut wrote his novels on a blue electric typewriter on a short brown table. Carved in the table, in white letters, are these words from Henry David Thoreau: "Beware of all enterprises that require new clothing." Writing in Walden, Thoreau says, "We need a transformed person in that clothing more than we need the new suit itself." Thoreau is perhaps the original asker, are you a human being or a human doing? Doing, having, owning, wearing, shopping, chasing, grasping. When do these pursuits drown out the whisperings of your heart and your soul? Thoreau sees everything as part of everything else. He saw people not as separate, but as connected to and morally responsible for one another. And from this mystic's vision came his resistance to unjust political systems. Last month, in Sacramento, the Reverend William Barber II gave a lecture at St. Mark's United Methodist Church, and the crowd there included a few Unitarian Universalists. Barber has led the NAACP in North Carolina, where he started the Moral Mondays civil disobedience protests for democracy and economic justice. In a powerful speech to us, Barber touched on crippling poverty and racism, and on threats to our democracy which have enabled injustice to grow. Barber said those issues are all moral issues. He named Americans who had resisted unjust systems in this country. He named Martin Luther King Jr. and Henry David Thoreau. Like them, Barber said, we must love our democracy enough to go to jail for it. After Henry David's 2 years at Walden Pond, the local tax collector found him. He told him that he owed back taxes on the local poll tax. This was a fixed amount levied on every white male adult, the people who could vote. Thoreau refused to pay it. He said he would not be an agent of injustice. He objected to American slavery and he opposed U.S. imperialism. Earlier in that year of 1848, the U.S. victory in the Mexican-American War had brought California, Texas, and New Mexico into United States possession. Imperialism, he called it. As punishment for his refusal to pay, Thoreau was put in the local jail. A relative paid the tax right away, and he was released after only one night there. While it may seem now to be a small sacrifice that he made, it's worth noting how rare civil disobedience was before Thoreau. He brought attention to the moral need for such resistance. Later, he gave a lecture in Concord, which was then published as an essay, Resistance to Civil Government. We know it as civil disobedience. Using the metaphor of the government as a machine, Thoreau writes that moral citizens must provide resistance when the state is moving in an unjust, immoral direction. Must provide a counteraction to the machine, he says. In like spirit, anti-war protesters have spoken of breaking the gears of our war machinery in passive resistance. Captain John Brown didn't believe that passive resistance was enough. A radical abolitionist, Brown argued that American slavery must be fought with force. In October of 1859, Captain Brown, a 59-year-old white man, led 16 white men and 5 black men in a raid on the United States Armory in Harper's Ferry, in Virginia at the time. His goal was to spur an insurrection of slaves and to give them weapons. Brown's raid failed, but it killed several men from the state militia and the U.S. Marines. Brown was convicted of treason and murder and hanged in December. Brown had already been a controversial figure for his violent efforts to stop the spread of slavery in Kansas. He was single-minded, obsessive, and militant. Many leaders regarded him as insane. A month before Brown was executed, Henry David Thoreau gave a speech in Boston to a crowd of 2,500 people. Thoreau said he was making a plea for Brown, not a plea for Brown's life, but for how to regard the man's character. He regarded Brown not as a traitor, but as a martyr. Thoreau said, newspaper editors argue that it is a proof of his insanity that Brown thought he was appointed to do this work. They talk as if it were impossible that a man could be divinely appointed in these days to do any work whatever. As if vows and religion were out of date as connected with any man's daily work. These men, in teaching us how to die, have at the same time taught us how to live. Thoreau predicted that Brown's acts and words would create a revival in the opposition of slavery in this country. He said that Brown's example has already quickened the feeble pulse of the North and infused more and more generous blood into her veins and heart than could any number of years of what is called prosperity. That attack is credited with raising the tensions which led to the Civil War. Indeed, barely more than a year later, the Confederacy fired on the Union's Fort Sumter, starting the war. Yet it has been argued that Thoreau's address, given to that large crowd in Boston and then published, that address is what sped up Northern and Southern animosities, and that it caused the Northern and Southern wings of the Democratic Party to run 2 separate candidates for president in 1860, enabling the Republican, Abraham Lincoln, to be elected. Was Thoreau endorsing the violence of John Brown's raid? It's not clear. But given the persistence of the violence of slavery, he made the case that an armed assault was an understandable response, an inevitable response. Indeed, slavery was ended only through the worst war in the nation's history. Captain John Brown didn't wait for the political system to bring force to the question of slavery. Though, of course, Jesus of Nazareth had been a nonviolent figure, Thoreau made a connection between the crucifixion of Christ for treason against the Roman Empire and the hanging of John Brown for treason against slavery's empire. As I noted earlier, Thoreau opposed the American Empire's war of expansion when he refused to pay his local tax. At the same time, Thoreau opposed the empire of conformity, social conformity. Our spiritual repression comes from a sense of duty and busyness and fear and conformity. It is caused by the distractions that keep us from receiving the simple gift of life. Thoreau calls this not living, not being awake to life. So today, in the spirit of Henry David, I urge you to take a few minutes every day this month of December, take a few minutes every day to be calm and still, whether you are walking or sitting. Take a few minutes every day. And in that stillness, be awake to life. Give thanks for yourself and your life and the miracle of life around you. And then for a few moments, just listen to the whisperings of your heart. And when you're done, say thank you. Bill McKibben, the environmental activist and writer, says Thoreau's example has given our modern consumer society the most deeply subversive question you can pose, and that is, how much is enough? McKibben says, we have been carefully trained to think that the answer is always more. Experimenting with simplicity, Thoreau monitored and measured how he spent his money and his time. He used quiet and stillness to listen to his heart and pay attention to the present moment. What would Thoreau think of our smartphones glowing and beeping all the time? Social media prodding us with updates? Non-stop news channels and endless YouTube distractions? Well, he does write this: men have become the tools of their tools. Yeah, don't we have so many devices and so many options that often we are not using them or choosing them, but being used by them? What would he say about Black Friday, Cyber Monday, Giving Tuesday, shopping malls, Amazon.com, and rentable storage sheds? Well, in observing the estate sales around his own town, Thoreau says they are evidence of how much the deceased was constrained by the stuff they owned. And soon, he writes, all that stuff will be crowding in somebody else's living quarters and somebody else's soul. Yet what he might say to us now is not how he feels about it. Instead, he might ask us how we feel about it. How does all this affect our own spirits, our relationships, and our sense of peace? How much is enough, and how do you know? These are subversive questions. They are spiritual questions, and moral ones, and political ones. The Russian writer Leo Tolstoy credits Thoreau's civil disobedience as formative of his own Christian pacifism. Mohandas K. Gandhi led India's freedom struggle on the principles of nonviolent resistance that combined his own tradition with Thoreau's philosophy. And then Martin Luther King Jr. drew inspiration from Gandhi's example. And at the neighborhood level, all around North America, experiments in simple living, conservation, tiny houses, growing our own food, reduce, reuse, recycle. Many movements can give credit to Thoreau's words about simplicity and about human life as part and parcel of the natural world. Henry David Thoreau died in 1862 from a series of respiratory illnesses ending in tuberculosis. He was 45. Sensing he would not recover, he revised lectures and essays to be published after his death. Except for 4 years at college and 2 years in that cabin 2 miles outside his town, Thoreau never moved away. He was born in Concord, and he died there. Yet he changed lives around the world. His courage in living and loving life has touched people of all traditions and places. His eloquence in recounting his motivations, choices, explorations, and questions has nourished so many spirits. He has inspired those of us who care about the quality of our lives together. Thoreau would be happy to know that many of us continue to love democracy, insist on freedom, care about the planet, and strive to simplify, take time offline, and get outside. Yet he would not want us to follow him, but follow our own hearts. This is his gospel. Live your life, not somebody else's. Whoever you are, your life is important, so make sure you are awake for it. Every day is a new opportunity to be awake for life. No being is isolated, human or otherwise. Everyone is connected to every other life in this world, interconnected, mutually dependent, and morally responsible. So may we strive to live, and so may it be. Blessed be. Amen.